Okay, let's see. We're going to start with page 94. Page 94. Let me tell you what how I'm going to organize this. It's I think it's one of the more important issues of our time. And sometimes some of the issues I'm going to talk about, I'm not going to talk about pornography. I'm going to talk about some of the more subtle, pervasive issues. And it goes without saying that there's a lot of positive stuff also. You know, Rav Hirsch put it best. He talked about that in talking about these kind of new technologies. The question is isolation versus inoculation. And my philosophy, which I think is the philosophy of many people here, is more inoculation, because isolation doesn't work. Today, there's no such thing as isolation when it comes to digital challenges, because kids will find it so pervasive and it's so necessary, and there's so much good that's part of it. So I'm going to start with the first point that I'm going to talk about has to do with the lack of awareness. Kind of the fact that there's so many unconscious forces at play here that we often don't even know. You don't know what you don't know. So I'll start with a quick vignette, and then a study. The vignette goes like this. Friday mornings, I mentioned in the last talk at YU, we give a sequence of classes in pastoral psychology. These are for third and fourth year smicha guys at YU. And the last two courses, we have professional actors come in. We got the idea from physicians. I have a son-in-law who was being tested for his boards. He told me that they had actors. He had to spend a day, I think, in Philadelphia, and these actors, he had to give exams to them, and I guess it's a routine part of boards now to show your clinical skills. So I thought, wouldn't that be great if we could do that with the smicha guys? We're preparing them for the rabbinate, which is now, in the modern Orthodox world, about 50%, a lot of pastoral stuff. It's very hard for them to get a feel for what it's really like. So we found the guys who do the acting for the boards, for the the boarding at the end of for getting your whatever the license is, the entry level boards. And we were able to get those guys to come to YU once a week for the most part during the last part of the guys' training, and we give them vignettes that we get from rabbis in the field. And it's pretty inherently fascinating. We have some pretty well-known actors. I mean, well-known bit actors. You know, one of the guys is a guy who was in just about every Woody Allen movie in a small part and a big part of one of them. Another guy has been on Law and Order about 50 times. He's a regular on Law and Order, the TV show. And these are very, very good, these guys. They understand the smicha guys. They've been doing it for years now with us. And they know how to give them feedback. They know how to pick up on mistakes that they're making as well as good things that they're doing. And they really get it. Even though none of them are Jewish, right now they're honorary Jews. They really, they get it. And it's really interesting. And it's always been interesting. It's always been pretty fascinating. And I noticed last year that there was less excitement in the class. And I started, together with the colleague I'm co-teaching the class with, we started walking to the back of the class to see what was happening on the guys' laptops as they were watching their colleagues going through the trial by fire of being interviewed and role-playing with the actors on these, really, because I'm telling you, you can make a TV show out of it. It's really interesting. I'm not making it up. It's a fascinating class. And the actors are terrific, and it's very anxiety-producing for the guys, but in a good kind of way. And we see one guy is buying a shirt on Brooks Brothers, and another guy Most of the guys are preparing the drusha for that Shabbos. They're all interning in various shuls. Some of the guys are, going back and forth between Facebook and texting and preparing drushas, and none of them were really engaged in what was happening. And you felt it in the kliss. It never happened before, but it was happening now. So I announced the next week to the guys, look, we're going to a no laptop policy. And I shared no computers in class policy for this class. And I explained to them why. I explained to them the research. Research shows the following, that when you have a laptop open, when you're taking notes on your computer during a class, you lose about 40% of the comprehension, which means that almost half of you is not there. But the important part of it is that you have no awareness. There's literally no awareness. You don't know, because you don't know what you don't know. You don't know. How could you know what you don't know? And the other thing that's interesting in the research is that the people sitting within your line of vision, they have about a 20% drop in their awareness, in their ability to concentrate, meaning that you're kind of a chote yamachti, okay, meaning that it's not that they can't learn at all, but they're doing a little bit less well. They're distracted, even though they may not even be aware they're distracted, but there have been a number of studies that show it. So I told the guys, look, this is why we're doing it. And the guys were extremely upset. They said, when are we going to prepare our drushas? When are we going to, we don't have any time. I've known them for years. I have a pretty good relationship with them. It's very unlike me to do it, but it was also very unlike them to push back, and they were angry. And they were angry because they thought it was arbitrary and it didn't make any sense. And they said, look, we're in the class. We're fine. It was about 8 of the guys in the class. Let's say there was a class of about 15 at this level. These are the fourth year guys. And that class, the first class, without their having any digital technology, was so qualitatively improved over the ones earlier in the semester. You just felt it. It was more of a give and take. It was more alive. Everybody was into it. And after class, the guys, all of those guys, asked to meet with me. And they sat down and they said, we're here to apologize. They basically said, we didn't understand the cost that it was having for us to be online. And we just weren't tuned into it. Basically, we didn't know what we didn't know. And from that point on, we don't allow this stuff. And we've gone back to baseline, which is, it's a very engaging and valuable class that the guys, talk about years after being out of smicha as being helpful in skills building. That's the first point I want to focus on. It's the fact that we don't know what we don't know. Let's talk about it. Let's start first with page 94, bottom right, continuous partial attention. It's a famous concept, but let's review what it is. This is basically from Linda Stone, who's was an Apple and Microsoft executive. And what she coined the term continuous partial attention, which talks about the sense of always being on, leading to chronic levels of low-level stress and overload. The part of you that keeps thinking, shouldn't I be checking my email now? What texts am I missing? What in my office is trying to get me, okay? It's an extremely hard thing to combat. Now, obviously, some of you here are physicians, and you have reasons that you really have to always be on. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the people who are always on, even though they don't always have to be on. And just to continue reading this, is when there's little recognition of this experience, interaction with our children, spouse, and friends can be subtly tainted by never being fully present in our day-to-day interactions. Let me move this to a fascinating experience I heard about a couple of years ago. I have a book that basically talks about this, but listen to this. In World War II, there was a very serious problem that one out of four men, when they'd go into combat, if American soldiers were going to combat, they were unable to kill. It's evidently not so easy to kill. So they'd go into combat, and they'd have to open up fire on the enemy in World War II, and 25% of the men just couldn't do it. They couldn't bring themselves to kill. It's a very serious problem. It means that the United States was effectively losing 25% of their fighting force. 25%, which is untenable, can't be. So they set up a program. There was a training program that the U.S. government set up to teach men how to kill, to teach men how to override the natural aversion to killing. Vietnam comes around, and by now you'd already had the Korean War, you had World War II. Vietnam comes around, and they're ready for the program that they had to have for both Korea and for World War II. And immediately it became apparent that there was no need to have the program anymore. Men had no trouble killing in the Vietnamese War. They canceled the program almost immediately because it was a worthless, there was no need. People, the first time they'd go into combat with no preparation at all, were able to kill. Anybody want to guess why? What happened between those wars? Huh? Yeah, I don't know if it's the Asian piece, because I think that there was still a problem in the Korean War. In the Vietnamese War, I think it's what other people said. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Different generation marked by what? Television, yeah. There's so much murder that you see on TV. I mean, the statistics I won't bore you with. But by the time these guys entered Vietnam, they had seen thousands of murders on TV, and it has an impact. You don't even realize it. Constantly seeing people being killed basically led to, it was the first generation raised on television. Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And my guess is, I think there are studies that are going on now, or even look, there are video games that teach you how to steal cars. There are video games that teach you, and there I would guess that I'm not up on what they're finding in that relative to these studies. I don't know of any comparative studies, but my guess is that it would have to be probably even more powerful because you're literally taking an active role. And, you know, it just makes this especially, we know that kids aren't murderers or heavy TV watchers, but what probably happens is the more vulnerable kids are more likely to be at risk for having that kind of an impact. So that's my opening thing I wanted to talk about, is sort of the unconscious nature of continuous partial attention and of hergel, of habituation, that we don't even realize. To the point, I'll tell you a quick vignette. You ready for a quick vignette? Or you rather have a slow vignette? Okay, here's a quick vignette. A few years back, I was asked to give a talk to a group of preschool teachers in Jewish day schools in Manhattan. Now, the first time I was asked to speak to that group, it's a large group of teachers from, you know, schools ranging, you know, like Heschel, Ramaz, and Park East, and, you know, the schools in that part of Manhattan, which tend to be very affluent, very, you know, modern Orthodox schools, wonderful, wonderful places that do an amazing job. But there, the first time I went, I was told the average age there in Manhattan, the kids get their first iPhone, is... first time I went, it was fourth grade. By fourth grade, 100% of the kids in those schools have iPhones. When I went back a year later, I asked, oh, by the way, when's the average age should kids get iPhones? A year later, it was third grade. 100% of third graders in those schools have iPhones. To the point, okay. So the head of one of the schools tells me that earlier that week, She walks into a room in a fourth grade class in her school, and she sees a group of girls with no guilt whatsoever, and not even being silly, trading pornographic pictures, but blatantly pornographic pictures. So one girl's saying, oh, look what I found, and they're sending it to each other, to each other's iPhones. So she walks in, and she takes the phone away from the girl who's doing the sending, and she says, what are you doing? And the girl looks up at her and says, what do you mean? She says, wait, you shouldn't be looking at these kind of pictures, and you certainly shouldn't be sharing it with your friends. And she looks up at her in total confusion, saying, I don't understand. I'm just sharing the pictures with the girls. She says, but these are inappropriate pictures. And the girl literally had no idea what she was talking about. You know, the Hebrew word busha is tied to the step back response. Okay, if you think about it, two times in Tanakh where you see a word related to busha is Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe. Moshe is hesitating from coming back from Har Sinai. And then his sister's mother, ki boshesh milavo, it means a break in the flow. The word yavesh, it's a break in the flow, it's stopping. And universally in all cultures, when somebody's embarrassed, they take a step back and they look down. That's the universal sign of busha, okay? Okay, it's a pause in the flow, thinking, is this worthy of me? She was seeing no busha, so she, the head of school, she calls up, she takes the iPhone away from the girl. That mother calls her up that night, furious, cursing at her, how dare you take my daughter's phone away? I demand that you give it back. She said, I demand that you do your job of monitoring your daughter's use of pornography when she's only a little, you know, she's this little 9-10-year-old girl. She can't be doing this, right? She just can't. You know, fourth grader shouldn't be doing this. This is just a couple of years ago. It's a couple of years. I'd say about 2-3 years ago. It's probably worse now. So, I mean, I don't know what it's down to, but this last year I heard it was down to third grade. So this happened, I think, 2 years ago. Anyway, the mother was furious. She said, I demand you give it back. And the teacher said, your daughter is not getting her phone back. And she's not be allowed to bring a phone to school until I see that you put on proper monitoring and filtering programs. Next day, the girl walks into school with the latest iPhone model. The mother bought her that. So I'm not saying this to horrify you. I'm saying it to see the direction this stuff can be going in if you don't get a handle on it and a handle on some of the subtle influence. So the point one that I'm talking about is some of these unconscious forces. And if you just look on two other studies on the bottom of page 95, I'll just show you. Study number one is just in 2015. They find that if you ask people, how often do you check your cell phones during the day? So the average person estimated 37 times during the day, which is pretty high. But they had access to their phones. They knew how often they really were checking their phones, and it was 85 times a day. So the average person was checking their phone once every 11 minutes, but they weren't aware of it. Again, a lot of it is unconscious, like the students in the Smichu program at YU. Okay, but then if you just look on the bottom bullet on the bottom left, and then I'll move on to the next topic. Even the presence of a cell phone, when kids walk into my office to see me in my, you know, in my office, the first thing I do is I take my cell phone and I shut it off and I hide it, either put it in my pocket or I hide it under my desk. And they say, what are you doing? I'll say, well, I'm making sure that we don't get in trouble. They say, but what if somebody calls you? What happens if somebody calls you? I'll say, I'm seeing you now, okay? And it often will trigger a conversation with them, often about their anger and hurt, about how often their parents interrupt their interactions with them to take calls. Listen to this story. I was at a Yachad Shabbos. a little bit, 2-3 weeks after Pesach. So it's like one of their big national, their big Shabbatonim. There are about 1,000 people there. It was their retreat, their annual retreat. And one of the topics I was asked to speak about was somehow related to this. And there was a guy in the audience who had a special needs kid, comes over to me and he says, you know, I'm a rabbi in town. And I read, when he told me his name, he's the rabbi of a big shul in New Jersey. And he said, let me tell you what happened to me in Pesach a couple of weeks ago. He said, my 20-year-old daughter seemed intent on stealing my afikoman. And I didn't know why. And she stole it. And when it came time to negotiate it for me to buy it back from her, she said, I'll tell you, Ab, I'll tell you what I want. I want you to spend just once 4 hours with me. Maybe take me out to dinner just once, 4 hours, but leave your cell phone at home. Okay? How's that? How's that? Smart girl. You know, there's a term, nichnas bo ke'eres shelachna, sort of it cut through him like a knife. Cut through him like a knife. And he realized, wow, this is important. So he told me that since then, I guess it was already 3 weeks into the Omer, if I remember correctly. He said that every Wednesday night since then, he's been taking his daughter out for 4 hours. He says he knows, he doesn't have, with a 20-year-old daughter, he doesn't know for how much longer she's going to be able to stomach being with him for 4 hours on a night without a cell phone. But he says it's been wonderful. And he's so happy that she still wants to connect with him, and it wasn't too late. Okay? But the reality is I hear over and over again from kids a feeling of hurt and abandonment when their parents are sitting down to dinner with them, constantly checking their cell phone. Their parents are there and not there. And it's often unconscious. When I bring it up to parents, when kids give me permission to talk to their parents about it, they often say, no, I'm not really, and they are. And they are, and it's unconscious, and it has an impact. Many of you know, or I'm sure all of you know, about the mirror neuron research. But let's talk about that and empathy. So here's the deal, okay? As I speak to you, and I'm looking at you, and I'm moving my hands like an old Jewish man, right? You're all a very attentive audience, and you're all making eye contact with me. So as I make eye contact with you, if we had a picture of the motor cortex of your brain, here's what we'd see. The motor cortex of my brain, you'd find some dedicated motor neurons going like this. But as you look at me, only as you look at me, eye to eye, face to face, heart to heart, you have mirror neurons where the exact same motor neurons in your motor cortex are going like this. Because we're hardwired for empathy. But only if you're looking eye to eye. If you're looking down, obviously that doesn't happen. And empathy is forged through eye to eye and face to face contact, right? It's not an accident that Moshe doesn't really get what's going on with his fellow Jews till he leaves the palace and Vayar Besivlosam. He sees with his own eyes the suffering of his fellow Jews. When he only hears about it, he doesn't get it the same way the Bali Musar tell us. So in terms of this next point is about basically the extremely important component of the importance of that presence, being presence when our kids are with us, even to the point of getting rid of the cell phone for a certain amount of time when you're interacting with your kids or whatever. Let's move on to page 97. And I want to talk a drop more about this, but I'm only going to talk about it from the standpoint of being versus doing. Yeah, actually it's page 96, bottom left, that I want to talk about. Okay, we just talked about, look at first the middle right. Empathy requires being. So Damasio, one of the leading theorists on the psychology of emotions, writes, empathy as well as deep thought depends on neural processes that are inherently slow. You could only be empathic, like we talked about last night, when you're focused, when you're there, when you're present. Listen to this study. They take a group of fourth grade girls, and they do something mildly upsetting to them. Half are randomly assigned to text their mothers for comfort, and half are randomly assigned to call their mothers for comfort. And they measure stress reactivity, cortisol levels, blood pressure, pulse rate, galvanic skin response, all those kind of measures of stress. The girls who text their mothers for comfort, it does nothing to their stress levels. The very same words spoken to the girls over the phone by their mothers in that condition lead to their totally being chilled out. The soothing words of their mother over the phone lead to cortisol levels going back to normal, blood pressure, pulse rate, all the measures of stress reactivity. But the very same words on text does nothing. Text is a very cold medium. Sometimes that helps. But it doesn't help when you're trying to soothe somebody. I remember I was in Toronto a number of years ago, I forget how many years ago, giving some talks. It was a beautiful sunny day. And I didn't realize that there was black ice on the roads. I didn't understand Canadian weather well enough. And I slip and badly break my arm, really badly, okay? Never healed, still broken, okay? I carry Canada with me wherever I go. But Toronto, not Montreal. And by the way, the care I got was unbelievably good and unbelievably, it was amazing. Everything about the response of everybody who was with me was amazing. So I have a bunch of nephews and nieces. I don't know exactly how many, 50, 60, a huge number, thank God. And some called me afterwards, okay, it wasn't such a big deal. I went back to work pretty much immediately. I actually gave that talk later that night because I just wanted to get my mind off of, I don't want to take painkillers or anything. So anyway, but some nephews and nieces texted me. And I got such a sense of the difference between even a phone call, let alone a visit. It was just a whole different deal when it was a phone call, We just have to understand that. We have to realize it. I spoke at a High Lifeline retreat this year. I do it every year since they started about 25 years ago. And a lot of the kids with cancer were telling me about the difference between their friends texting them to stay in touch and their friends visiting them or calling them. They say the friends aren't even tuned into it. To them, it's all the same. It's the way they communicate. It's like they breathe. One more point on this. Oh, wait, I'm going till 12:30, right? So one more point on this, so we're good with time. And it's a study you may have heard about, but we're going to talk about being versus doing. Shabbos is about being. The week is about doing. We're doing here. Shabbos, when we go into Shabbos, it's going to be a whole different feel in this hotel, right? We go into a different zone of time, the zone of being, not doing. So I'll just share with you my favorite study. Some of you may have heard about it. It was a famous study, July 4th issue of Science Magazine, 2014, page 96, bottom left. But don't read the slide. Let me say it over to you. Here's what they do. They take people, it's 11 studies described in the Science Magazine article paper. And they take people, they put them alone in a room, they take away their cell phone, it's just the four walls of the room, and you're asked to be alone with your thoughts, think about your life, just be. People are asked to be. And it shouldn't be surprising to everybody here how incredibly difficult that was for people. They hated it. They hated it. So they thought, well, maybe it's a generational thing. It didn't matter. They did it with old people, young people, middle-aged people. It didn't matter. Your age didn't matter. People hated it. People hated it. But here's where this study really gets interesting. They take a subgroup of the people, and they do the following. They bring them into a room. Same way, take their cell phone away, and they're asked to spend between 6 and 15 minutes alone in the room. But here they add another condition to this arm of the study. They take an electroshock machine that delivers mildly painful electric shock. And they say, look, no pressure. Just sit in the room, be alone with your thoughts, think about your life. Just be in the room for the next, 6 to 15 minutes. They don't tell them exactly how long, but they know it's not going to be more than 15 minutes. But then they say, oh, by the way, here's how to use this machine. It could give you a mildly painful electric shock. No pressure. You could either sit alone with your thoughts, or if you get really bored, give yourself a shock. Pretty crazy, right? As you'll see in the bottom bullet, okay, 67% of the men and 25% of the women chose to shock themselves instead of being left alone with their thoughts. I'll say it again. 67% of the men shocked themselves. Okay? Now, why far fewer women didn't, that's a talk in itself, okay? But even 25% of the women chose to shock themselves. I don't remember. But my guess is, I don't know. I certainly know some people who probably were constantly shocking themselves, it wouldn't surprise me, okay? But again, it's being versus doing. And yet we know, if you just look at it developmentally, if you look at the middle left slide on page 97, you need stillness. You need stillness in order to survive life. Adolescents, more than any other age group, need to find a place of stillness, a place that there's no distraction. 1,000 years ago, Rabbeinu Bachya coined a four-word tefillah. Hashem yatzileni mipizur hanefesh. God send me from fragmentation of my soul. Shabbos is the opposite of pizur. Shabbos is the opposite of peace. That's what we're going into, right? Like you leave your cell phone off and away if you're lucky enough to be in a field that you could shut off that way. And if you just want to look, a picture's worth 1,000 words, turn to page 98, middle right, and you'll see a picture of Pizur. And it says something, I think, very important if you look at it. So you see that's the brain. The brain on the right is multitasking. And look at how lit up it is, okay? It's very lit up, okay? But it's a mile wide and an inch deep. So that's fragmentation. There's no depth. The same brain on the left is unitasking. Imagine a brain learning Gemara or learning Chumash or being engaged in a novel with no distraction. That's the brain on the left. Small part is lit up, but it's deep. It's focused. And that's what we have to go for, okay? So again, the picture on the right is Pizur. The opposite of Pizur HaNefesh is the Menuchas HaNefesh of the being of Shabbos. So that finishes that section. And now I want to go on to talking a little bit about the online disinhibition effect. If you look on page one, I'm sorry, yeah, please. Right, so the question is, what do you do with half Shabbos? It's yeah, and what happens is, it's pretty pervasive. I talked, here, it's not easy to shock me, but I was asked to speak at a Beis Yaakov school in Borough Park. There are many, many Beis Yaakovs in Borough Park. So I asked to speak in one of them, and they said, look, the girls here aren't allowed to have cell phones, and they think we're old-fashioned, and they're giving us a very hard time. They basically said, maybe if they hear from a shagetz like you, they didn't say that, maybe they hear from a modern guy like you, they'll accept it. So I go, and I talk to the girls a little bit about some of the stuff that we're talking about some of the more subtle costs. I said, you're so lucky, I wish I could get rid of this thing, I'm a slave to this thing, okay? And I spoke to them. But I saw I wasn't really reaching them because they supposedly didn't have any smartphones. So I turned to the faculty. I said, look, could I be alone with the girls? There was 400 girls in the auditorium. And they said, sure. So I'm left alone with the girls. And I turn to them and I say, guys, I sense that there's more going on here than meets the eye. I said, look, I'm anonymous. I don't know your names. You don't know me. I don't know you. We live in different worlds. I say, what's going on here? After a little bit of a silence, one of the girls says, we all have phones. We all have phones. Everybody has a phone. I said, and how many of you are on social media? And then little by little, they started opening up. They started opening up. They said, of course we have phones, and we have backup phones. And in case they say, look, we could just take money from one babysitting job and go to CVS and go to one of the local drugstores and buy a phone and have enough, you know, and be able to text and be able to go on social media. And we have multiple ways of entering on. They say, we know this stuff. Our parents don't know this stuff. Fine, I wasn't shocked by that, but we had a nice talk about the pros and the cons. Then we had to leave. They had to go back to class. So a group of about 40 girls come around me to talk. And they really seemed to need to talk. And it turns out, they say, do you know how many girls here are texting on Shabbos? This is a Beis Yaakov in Borough Park. A Beis Yaakov in Borough Park. Again, I could tell you because I don't know how many there are, but there are a lot of them, okay? And then when you talk to them about why, the number one fear of every adolescent is being left out, is not belonging. And it's FOMO, right? And FOMO is real, especially in adolescents. And they stop, I think, when they get older and they understand a little bit more about it and they feel a little more secure. I think it's a temporary problem. I have a PowerPoint that I often give on 6 recommendations and 6 contributing factors to texting on Shabbos. We did a little bit of research on it, and we have some interesting numbers on it. But the bottom line is that I'll end the answer to this question with a quick vignette. I'm on the West Coast, speaking to a small high school, wonderful high school there, to a group of boys. It was an all-boys high school. And somehow this comes up. This topic comes up. And they're talking about their phone. And again, I'm anonymous, so people open up to me. You know, when I'm anonymous, I don't know them, they don't know me, and they're really talking to me. There's no faculty around. And they're talking about texting on Shabbos, even though they come from very frum households. And a kid who's clearly a cool and accepted kid in the back, he starts talking. He says, guys, you know my story. You know I'm a Baal Tshuva. You know I didn't even know what this Shabbos thing was till about a year ago. And when I heard that you can't use your phone on Shabbos, I said, forget it. No way, that's not for me. And I texted on Shabbos, just like you guys do. He said, but then, about 6 months ago, I decided to try not texting. I decided to just really keep Shabbos. And I got rid of my phone on Shabbos. Parents have us put the phone next to the candles when they bench lift, and I just don't text. And he turns to all of his classmates. He says, guys, you got to try it. It is awesome. It is awesome. He says, you're not going to believe it. Give it a shot. You're not going to believe it. He says, it is so nice. And you see all the kids looking wide-eyed. The answer is, I know I'm not really answering that, but the answer is a combination. Again, there are 6 factors. Some of it is FOMO. Some of it is parents who were sort of complicitly going along with it because it's the easiest thing to know. You know, it's not hard to know what your kid's cell phone usage is and to see what time of day you're giving a very clear message by not checking it. You know how easy it is nowadays to be able to press a couple of buttons and to shut off your kid's access to online stuff on Shabbos? It's one command. There's so many new programs out there now. It's the easiest thing in the world to track. And if they have 1 million phones, there are ways of tracking that as well. There are ways of doing this. It's not guaranteed. Ultimately, the answer is the relationship with your child. The key is going to be really having a connection with them. And that leads me, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. That's why it's so important to get, I mean, that's why, so that's getting me to the recommendations. What recommendations to parents? What are you supposed to do about this? And what do we know works? Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's a big component to this. In that PowerPoint I have on half Shabbos, I spend a lot of time talking about that, and maybe sometime over Shabbos I will. Yeah, so, and that's what the research shows. So let me cut to the heart of my recommendations here. We're down to our last 17 minutes, so let me come to the recommendations. So if you turn to page 101, maybe I'll just start with, I'll go through the summary, the parent's overview on top right, and I'll just go through it. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, so I asked the girls if I could. I gave them, there was an assumption of what they were telling me was confidential. So I said, I asked them, is it okay if I talk to some of them? So they weren't so with it. So I did meet with the faculty. Whenever I give these kind of talks, I meet with the faculty afterwards, and I review with the kids what I can and can't speak about. They did not want me to, okay? They see, in a different kind of school, if I'm talking about digital technology, I work with the kids usually for a couple of hours in the morning. I come up with a contract, a parent-child contract on digital use. You're about to see a sample of one in a few minutes. And then I ask the kids, what do you think is reasonable? And then at night, I go over with the parents what the kids said they think is reasonable. Parents are often shocked by how much their kids are willing to accept or even looking for. That's what we're getting for. In that particular case, it was a little unusual because the faculty was so out of touch with where the girls were. So I just told them, I said, look, there's a lot more going on than you think. I'm not at liberty to say. And you know what? They didn't want to know. They didn't want to know. The faculty really, really did not want to go. I go to many other schools where faculty does want to know and is very interested in you know, moving ahead. That faculty did not want to know. They were feeling disconnected, but to, you know, me just telling them wouldn't have mattered anyway, because it's so much deeper than that. It's about, you know, opening your eyes to the reality of what's out there, and it's painful. It's painful. Yeah. No. I hear what you're saying. Okay. So let me move on now to the main points. Okay. So we're going to do that top right slide. LA study: Kids Want Limits. A fascinating study done by Debbie Fox in Beverly Hills. Debbie Fox is a wonderful, she's a clinician in the Beverly Hills community. If you could ever get Debbie to come here, Rabbi Kelman, if you're ever looking for an incredible speaker here, if you could figure out a way to get Debbie Fox to come to one of these conferences, she's an amazing speaker and amazingly brilliant and wonderful woman. And yeah, you check her out, you'll see. But anyway, so Debbie did the following study. I was coming to speak to parents in the Beverly Hills area and the kids. I remember in the Simon Wiesenthal Center auditorium, a pretty big auditorium, and it was packed because the kids were told that if they come, they didn't have to do homework, I think, for the next of the week. These were high school kids. And the kids made sure their parents came, but they had to bring their parents with them. So we had a packed audience. But to get ready for this, Debbie gave an online survey to the kids, all the high school kids, of all the high school from left to right, all the Jewish schools in the Beverly Hills, Los Angeles area, and in the Valley. And asking the kids a bunch of questions about, among other things, the best question is what I'll share with you now. She asked the following. She said, when you are parents and you have teenagers of your own at home, how are you going to handle the internet differently than your parents did with you? Great question. Do you know that most of the kids said, we're going to be much stricter when we're parents? So when I read their responses, Debbie showed it to me, it was fascinating. They'd say things, if only I could get those images out of my mind that I saw that I shouldn't have seen online. There's a lot of, when I speak to kids privately or, you know, in these school meetings about these things, many of them are very troubled about the pornography and what it does to their souls. They're troubled by it and they feel there's nobody to talk to. And it bothers them and they have intrusive images, about 25% of them. Other kids said, how am I going to ever get back the time I squandered being up to 3-4 in the morning? And they basically said, I'm going to be stricter. Most of the kids said they're going to be stricter. And that's what the research shows. The Kaiser Family Foundation did a large-scale study that showed two things. Kids want limits. They want the limits to be reasonable. They want them to be fair. And that's the contract I'll show you. But they also, when limits are put on kids, it works. That's what the Kaiser Family Foundation showed. They're reasonable. If you find the balance between love and limits, it tends to work. So that's recommendation number one. Number two is that I just did. Number three, it's balance, balance, balance. It's the balance between love and limits. And it's an art. And it's going to be different with each of your children. So what works with one child isn't going to be what works with another child. I think I'm going to talk about it tonight and tell you some stories to illustrate this when I speak tonight at the meal. Okay? But everything is balance. Okay? And then be reasonable and have your child wanting to come to you. And now let's go to a sample, sort of the kind of contracts that seem to work. If you turn to page 102, and I'll now come to the end. Here's a contract that comes from Dr. Gold, a child psychiatrist in Manhattan, who is coming from a very liberal place. She has a practice, a very successful practice in Manhattan, and is a respected child psychiatrist with kids in the west side and east side of Manhattan, very wealthy kids. And everything she's saying here is coming from the standpoint of somebody who's practicing in a very liberal community. And look at what she writes, okay? And it's accepted, and people are doing this, okay? Number one. Keep technology out of the bedroom as much as possible. We all know why. It's hard for kids to fall asleep, and you can't monitor it. And kids, if you model it for keeping your technology out of your bedroom and putting it in a public area, recharging your phone every night in the kitchen or something. That's number one. Number two, don't let children sleep with technology for obvious reasons. It interferes with their sleep, and it steals their time. And because of FOMO, they could be up till all hours of the night. Teach your children to ask permission to use technology. Now, it's harder to do this with an adolescent. But certainly, if you start with younger kids, and kids see it not as a right, but as a privilege, and you build that in. I've been speaking to parents of preschoolers, parents of school-age kids, before it's too late. You could do this very easily if you start young enough. Limit weekday technology, which will vary from family to family. Download, buy games and apps yourself. Don't let your children do so. Only you should have the ability to download apps. There's a wonderful site that is a very reputable site with good research on it, Common Sense Media, that'll tell you the appropriate apps for every age group. It's a free app, and you could do it. I mean, I use it, and it finds excellent, excellent apps that are very appropriate, and they're very careful in the way they vet the apps. Yeah. You know what? So there's no right, and I talk to schools about that all the time, and I hear, and that's real. But you know what the reality is? The reality is that's fine. It means that school work should be done, online school should be done in a common area of the house, okay? And there should be a very clear limit on how long, and find out from the teacher what's a reasonable amount of time to be able to do these assignments. And that right away blows it up. It blows it up. It should be public. Because otherwise, what kid is going to be able, can you resist checking your texts and your emails and social media if you're doing work? It's hard to. It's hard to stay focused. And kids with their brains underdeveloped brains, of course they're not going to be able to. You know, it's just common sense. And they're right. I'm sure they are. They're doing that and probably 10 other things if they're normal kids. Okay. Tell your children to report inappropriate games. Don't permit technology use during meals. designate screen-free time for the entire family. It's a very important one. And basically, you do it, and then you'll see there are different recommendations for preschoolers and different recommendations for adolescents, which is the hardest one. But the whole idea is, for each kid, it's going to be a little bit different. You know, the Kutzker said it beautifully. Kutzker said, there is nothing as unequal as the equal treatment of children. Okay? That captures a lot, right? And so you may have to have it a little bit differently for each kid. If it's coming from a fair place, kids will probably accept it. Before we go to maybe time for one or two questions, let me end with a story. Okay. I'll end with the story of the three questions, okay? And that should be just about right. And unfortunately, I won't allow time for questions, but maybe later there'll be time. It goes like this. I go to a shiva. Shiva for a wonderful man. His name is Rabbi Abitan. I don't know if anybody knows him. Some of you may know his children. He has kids. Two or three of them are physicians. Very respected physicians. They're all wonderful kids. You know the family. He was an amazing man, Rabbi Abitan. A wonderful pastoral rabbi, an incredible Talmud Chacham. He was Moroccan. Very, very beloved, incredible Anav. I could just go on and on telling you what a wonderful man he was. And he died after a long, productive life. And into the shiva, whole family is sitting shiva in his house near the shul he had in Atlantic Beach, was it, or Long Beach. And into the shiva walks a guy, clearly not Jewish looking, and clearly a little confused. And when the kids sitting shiva see him, they're kind of shocked, because it turns out they're in related fields. They immediately recognize him as, you know, one of the leading cardiac thoracic surgeons in the U.S., but world-renowned. And they say, what's this guy, this non-Jewish world-renowned guy coming to my father's shiva? They had no idea. They want to stand up. They can't. You're not allowed to stand up out of respect for anybody. And he sees that they're kind of thrown. And he says, look, he said, I'm not Jewish. I never played a condolence call before. But I just want to tell you this story about how your father saved my life. And then I'll leave. Is that okay? Everybody's going, yeah, okay, sounds good. And he goes on, he tells the following story. He says that about 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier, I forget how long, he was doing surgery in his OR in Manhattan. Doing bypass surgery. During the surgery, he gets a phone call that a brother, much younger than him, had died. Had died suddenly. He'd never been sick a day in his life. His brother is much younger, and certainly much younger than the men and women whose lives he's routinely extending with his surgery. People are coming from all over the world to have surgery with him. And the man, his brother dies. And he was very close to his brother, and he's devastated beyond what one would normally be. It's just because he keeps saying with every surgery he does, I failed my brother, I failed my brother. I mean, just sort of he feels irrationally that it was his fault. He had no way of knowing. His brother was totally asymptomatic. And he takes a little bit of a leave of absence, goes back. He's not himself. And nothing's helping. No therapists he's going to are helping. He's just totally, totally destroyed. And then he remembers that many years earlier, he had done surgery on a very holy, spiritual man. So it was Rabbi Abitan. And he goes, and he calls up Rabbi Abitan. He says, look, I don't know if you'll see somebody who's not Jewish, but you may remember me. I did surgery on you. Rabbi Abitan says, do I remember you? You saved my life. You've given me the last 15 years. Of course, I'll see you. I'm happy to help you any way I can. And he comes, and the doctor tells Rabbi Abitan what had happened. Rabbi Abitan says, fine. He says, look, He says every human being has a torch, have a soul, and the soul's lit by a torch. And the flame that gives your life meaning was extinguished with the death of your brother. He says, nobody could tell you how to relight the torch. You have to find it. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. Let's meet once a week. You have more time on your hand. I think he'd cut down his surgery schedule a little bit. Go home and read. Read whatever you could find. Come to me once a week to my office. We'll sit down and we'll schmooze for a couple of hours, and maybe you'll find the answer. And it becomes the high point of this doctor's week. And he loves the sessions with Rabbi Avitan, but it's not working. But about 3-4 months into the process, he comes skipping into Rabbi Avitan's office. And he says, Rabbi, I don't have to come anymore. I'm fine. Back to full schedule at the hospital. I'm good. Rabbi Avitan said, what happened? He said, I read a Tolstoy short story. It's called The Three Questions. You could Google it. Not now, later. You could Google it. And it goes like this. Tolstoy says, when you have somebody in front of you, you have to ask three questions. Here are the three questions you have to ask. Question number one is, what's the most important time? We all know the answer to that. Not now, when. The most important time is now. Question number two you have to ask yourself when you have somebody in front of you is, what's the most important thing to keep in mind when you have somebody in front of you? We know the answer to that. Do chesed. Olam chesed yibaneh. The world is built on acts of loving kindness. And question number three is, who's the most important person? And the answer to that is the person in front of you. Somehow that energizes him. He goes back to operating. If you were a fly on the wall in his OR today when he's doing surgery, here's what you'd see he does with his whole team. He doesn't care who you are. You could be the anesthesiologist, the fellows, the whole team. Huge team. Here's what you have to do to operate on this doctor's team. They form a circle around the patient, and he screams out to them, what's the most important time? And they have to scream out, now. What's the most important thing? Do good. Who's the most important person? The person in front of us. Let's operate. That gave him back his soul, gave him back the light. And that's the key to the answer of everything we've been talking about in terms of the multiplicity of our response to the challenges and promises of digital media. Thank you, everybody.